From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Solar energy is one of the most contentious topics you can find. Some see it as the key to a sustainable energy system, while others say it's a complete boondoggle. My next guest started off firmly in that first camp. And to be fair, he probably still is. Varun Sivaram has moved from the ivory tower of academia to the nitty-gritty of municipal governance, and through a few tech startups, he is now back in the academic world as the Philip D. Reed Fellow for Science and Technology at the Council on Foreign Relations, and a fellow at Columbia University's Center for Global Energy and Policy. And along the way, he has come face-to-face with all of the differing views of solar, and he's now attempting to put them all together and put them into perspective in his new book, Taming the Sun. Varun, thanks for talking with us. Welcome to the show.
Heather, thanks so much for having me.
You say that we are at a decision point, kind of globally, and that as soon as 2050, we could be living in one of two very different kinds of worlds. Can you describe for us what these two possible different futures are that you see for humanity?
Absolutely. I actually see for the next decade or so, these two paths kind of line up, but then they start to diverge a decade or more out from today. By 2050, in the first future, we could be in a world where the solar power revolution has sputtered out, the clean energy transition's on pause, fossil fuels still dominate the landscape, and they generate most of our power, run most of our factories, and fuel most of our cars, ships, trucks, and planes. And as a result, people live in horribly polluted megacities. They face increasing congestion, and climate change is taking a toll on the world and is only speeding up because the world has failed to find a way to control its carbon emissions. So a lot of terrible consequences in that first future.
Right. That's pretty apocalyptic. What's the alternative?
The alternative isn't the polar opposite. It's not like, you know, all of our problems have been solved. But at least, even though there are still these grave challenges, climate change will still exist. I think the world will be more in control of its own destiny because solar power will have anchored this ongoing shift toward clean energy. Fossil fuels, for the first time in history, will actually be on the wane. And the world will have bought itself enough time to do some even harder things than reducing its emissions from dirty energy. It might even have to suck carbon out of the air. To buy that time, I think that solar power could continue to rise over the next 30 years. And by 2050, solar power could generate a third of the world's electricity and be well on its way to powering most of our energy needs.
Why solar specifically? I mean, your book is Taming the Sun, not Taming the Wind or the Atom. Why not wind or nuclear? Why not a mix of all of those and just renewables more broadly? Why so specifically solar?
So I see a huge role for both of those resources to play, and I do want to see a mix. But the reason I focused in on solar is that more energy hits the Earth from the sun every hour than the world uses in a whole year. Solar power is by far our most abundant source of energy, and it happens to be clean and renewable. And so I think that solar offers the number one source of clean, virtually inexhaustible energy to harness.
If you ask proponents of solar, they will say that the only thing standing between us and that solar-powered future is kind of political. We have all the technology we need. And if you ask people on the other end of the spectrum, they will tell you there's no way, we don't have the batteries, we don't have the technology. This just isn't technically feasible, regardless of what policies we put into place. And you said you wrote this book in part to try to maybe not reconcile those, but at least understand those and see if there is a middle ground or a consensus. So if you tried to give us that more middle ground, realistic view of the future of solar, what is it that's standing in the way? Is it technology? Is it policy? Or is it a little bit of both?
Yep, it's all of the above. You know, I think each of those two perspectives gets something right and something wrong. Solar power definitely has enormous potential. So the naysayers that say, you know, this is a gimmick are probably wrong. But we're not there yet. We don't have all the technology we need yet. And it's not just about political will. So I argued that, you know, even though solar has come a long way, just a decade ago, solar cost over 10 times as much, it still has a long way to go. If we don't invest in three kinds of innovation over the next few decades, solar could hit a wall. It could hit a wall before it reaches that 33% of global electricity that I say is crucial for the world to be on the right path to combating climate change. And the three kinds of innovation I want to see us invest in are financial innovation, to bring in trillions of dollars to keep deploying solar. Technological innovation, new technologies to convert sunlight into electricity, into heat, and into portable fuels that could actually compete with oil. And systemic innovation, to refashion our electricity and other energy systems so that they can productively use solar power, even though it is highly volatile and fluctuates a lot. All three of those innovations are going to be necessary collectively if we're going to actually harness solar's full potential. So we're not there yet.
I'm talking with Varun Sivaram. He is author of Taming the Sun. Let's dig into each of those three areas of innovation. And let's start with technological first. This is where you kind of started your career. You were, you know, a grad student in Oxford working on new solar technologies. What do those look like? Are they tweaks of the solar panels that we're all familiar with now, different materials, more efficient? Or are we talking about completely revamping what solar power looks like?
I think in the long run, we're talking about a revolutionary take on what solar power looks like, although the best way to get to that revolution might actually be a more evolutionary or incremental route. So when I worked in Oxford, I was in Dr. Henry Snaith's laboratory, and that lab, we invented a new technology called the perovskite solar cell. And this new technology is remarkable. In contrast to today's technology, silicon solar panels, which are ubiquitous and, you know, they are heavy, rigid, kind of ugly. You've seen them on roofs. In contrast to that technology, perovskites can do a whole range of things. They can be flexible, colorful, semi-transparent. They have dirt-cheap elements, and they could be even more efficient than today's silicon panels. So you can literally print out rolls of solar material out of an inkjet printer, and that's what I see happening in the distant future. You know, we could have coatings of these perovskite solar materials covering skyscrapers or, you know, adorning weak roofs in the developing world. Now, the problem is that for such a new technology to get out of the laboratory and into the marketplace is going to be extremely difficult given that there's a strong incumbent today. Silicon solar technology dominates the market. It's a $160 billion industry and 90% is silicon. So I think the most promising route is actually an evolutionary route. In the near term, we might see silicon solar panels with a perovskite layer on top that boosts the efficiency or the amount of sunlight that today's panels turn into electricity. And that might enable the entrepreneurs and scientists of today to get some experience manufacturing perovskite coatings. And then down the road, once they've got that manufacturing experience and scale, I think that evolution could turn into a revolution. You could see standalone perovskite solar products that look radically different. You know, you could one day solar coat your house just as cheaply as painting it.
What is perovskite?
It turns out to be an intricate material at the nanoscale, and that's why it behaves so well at the macro scale. Perovskite refers to the crystal structure. It's similar to the most common element in the Earth's crust. But what we've done as engineers is used a combination of organic and inorganic atoms, put them together in this crystal structure, and that's what works so well. Its constituent atoms are lead, an organic compound, chlorine. These are cheap, earth-abundant elements. They wouldn't add much to the cost of a solar coating.
When you left graduate school, you went to work as a special advisor to the mayor of Los Angeles. What was the moment when you realized that, hey, all this technology that we've been working on creating that I thought, you know, we just needed to find the right people and put it into play, actually there's a longer path from creating new technologies to putting them into play on the scale that cities and states are already looking to deploy solar?
I'll say I came into the mayor's office as a very naive recent doctoral student. And so I thought, of course, these radical revolutionary technologies we were developing in the lab, we'd easily be able to scale them up and deploy them for a whole city. And then in Los Angeles, I took this helicopter ride out over the Mojave Desert, and I flew over a real solar farm, a massive solar farm. You know, it covers football fields worth of space, and these panels are just stretching out as far as the eye can see. And I remember looking at those panels thinking, oh my God, all of the tiny little fingernail-sized solar cells that I've made in my lab that, you know, were fantastically efficient, but on a really tiny miniature scale, there's no way we could build this many of them There's no way we could scale up the manufacturing equipment and carpet the desert the way this existing incumbent dominant technology has. So it hit me that there's a whole lot of work in between building a radically new technology at the nanoscale and then scaling it up to cover, you know, miles and miles of desert. Now, that said, I do think that it's important that we bridge that gap. In the city of Los Angeles, you know, city officials had many important priorities. They needed to make sure that the lights stayed on for 4 million residents, and so they did not take very many technology bets. But in the long run, if humanity is to combat climate change, for example, or the United States is to, you know, change its dominant source of energy from fossil fuels to solar, I do think that we're going to have to scale up brand new technologies from the lab. And that's going to take sustained funding from private investors, as well as, in my opinion, from the public sector. I think that the government's got to fill some of the funding gap that exists for commercializing some of these technologies.
I'm talking with Varun Sivaram. He's author of Taming the Sun. Transitioning from current technology to revolutionary new technology is going to require, as you said, also systemic innovation and financial innovation. What do we need to do? Let's start with our electricity system, to our grid and our whole electricity system, in order to massively deploy either the technology we have now or this, you know, potentially new perovskite technology in the future.
Exactly. Because whether or not you have today's technology, silicon solar panels, or tomorrow's solar coatings from perovskites or something else, you're still going to have the problem where the sun shines only at particular parts of the day. It hides behind the clouds. It's really bright in some areas and not in other areas. So in order to buffer this intermittency, our electricity systems need to be far more flexible. There's an intuitive solution. You might think, oh, batteries are getting way cheaper, so we can just deploy a whole lot of storage, and that storage will enable us to take the solar power that's generated at an inconvenient part of the day, say the middle of the day when there's too much solar power, and shift it to the evening. Even though that's intuitive, though, it turns out to be extremely expensive to actually pair every single solar panel with a battery. So I don't think that's the silver bullet. I think that batteries falling in cost is great, and that's one component of a portfolio of solutions. I like to say that there's probably a battery of approaches, of which only one is actually a battery.
All right, so...
Heather, I appreciate you laughing at that.
Bad puns aside, what are the other things in that battery of changes that we need to make?
So in addition to using batteries, you might also make your electricity grid a lot bigger. See, the bigger your electricity grid is, the bigger the area over which you're trying to match supply and demand is. And that makes it easier to line them up. You can connect areas where supply of solar power is abundant with areas where you demand energy at that particular time. In addition to bigger grids, you might make your grid smarter. If your grid can recruit, you know, millions or even billions of internet-connected devices at home and turn them on and off, or send them price signals so they can voluntarily vary their usage so that they're demanding electricity when the solar power is available, well, that enables you to productively use your solar power no matter when it's produced or how much it fluctuates.
That's Varun Sivaram. He is the Philip D. Reed Fellow for Science and Technology at the Council on Foreign Relations, a fellow at Columbia University's Center for Global Energy and Policy, and author of Taming the Sun. Varun, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Heather.
Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.